Welcome to Everyday Wellness Podcast. I'm your host, nurse practitioner Cynthia Thurlow. This podcast is designed to educate, empower, and inspire you to achieve your health and wellness goals. My goal and intent is to provide you with the best content and conversations from leaders in the health and wellness industry each week and impact over a million lives. This is the second class in the Lipid Masterclass with Dr. Thomas Dayspring, who is a fellow of both the American College of Physicians and the National Lipid Association, and is certified in both internal medicine and clinical lipidology. Dr. Dayspring joins me again, and in the second segment, we are talking about what is cardiovascular disease, as well as lipoproteins, the progression of atherogenesis, the impact on ischemia, infarcts, which are myocardial infarctions, which are heart attacks. How does ApoB invade arterial walls? And what are the labs and the significance of them? How do we treat ApoB with both lifestyle and pharmacotherapy? The importance of finding the right competent provider, especially as a woman is navigating the perimenopausal to menopausal transition, as well as changes that he observed in clinical practice, and why bikini medicine does not appropriately treat women's needs. And lastly, we talk about some of the issues related to hormone replacement therapy and potential side effects. I know you will enjoy this conversation as much as I did recording. Again, this is the second conversation with Dr. Dayspring, and we have several additional masterclasses coming. And so let's, for the benefit of listeners, let's talk about what is atherosclerosis. You know, you mentioned ASCVD. We used to call it cardiovascular disease, coronary artery disease, vascular disease. Let's talk about what it is, because it is very different than how I was talking about ASCVD when I was a new nurse practitioner. Even as a new nurse, I worked at a premier kind of hospital in Maryland that did a high volume of cardiac caths. We saw a lot of coronary artery disease. We understand it better now, but let's help understand and define what exactly this represents.
Yes, because if we really all understood it, we could put those invasive cardiologists out of business and they could get into preventive cardiology, where you would save a hell of a lot more lives than trying to fix those. So already, it is still fixable, thank God, if you do not diagnose this early in life. But yeah, it's all prevention. So everything we're talking about today, even when we started to define lipids, ultimately this becomes important because there is one place in the human body. I told you cholesterol is essential for all the cells in our body, but the one tissue it's not essential for is the arterial walls in our body. Arteries are the blood vessels that carry plasma away from the heart to supply tissues. And of course, our veins return unwanted stuff back to the heart, actually to the liver, and the liver can redecide what to do again. So cholesterol, I told you, is going to be in one of these lipid transportation vehicles. I've told you a lot of the story of the HDL so far. There's a little bit more to tell, but this is a good time to tell you about the other family of lipoproteins. ApoA1 is the structural protein for an HDL particle. There is a blood test called ApoA1. If you order it, we used to think, oh, you're counting HDL particles. But I already explained, because there could be 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5 ApoA1s per HDL particles. ApoA1 is a very poor indicator of HDL particle concentration. It's a blood test that nobody needs to order anymore, because you get more information from looking at other lipid lipoprotein metrics. So let's talk about the other family of lipoproteins. I've already hinted that these big chylomicrons come out of your intestine, but there's a very big lipoprotein that comes out of your liver, which is like a smaller version of a chylomicron, and that would be the VLDL, very low density lipoprotein. Now, obviously, these are much bigger carriers of lipids than our HDL particles. That's why they tend to float more in the centrifuge tube, but they have to have a very big structural protein to enwrap the huge amount of lipid molecules they carry. And that apoprotein is called apoprotein B, with a capital B. And there is only one ApoB per member of the ApoB particle family. And that is kind of cool because we could ask the laboratory, give me an ApoB concentration, and basically you're counting all of these ApoB particles that might be floating in the plasma during at the time you did the vena puncture. All right. Again, just for accuracy, it's a minutial thing that doesn't affect clinical lipidology, but the intestine produces these monstrous chylomicrons, the major lipid component in the core there. Yes, there is some cholesterol ester there. That's the cholesterol you absorbed, and the enterocytes stuck it in the core of the lipoprotein, the chylo, after esterifying it. So it's cholesterol ester, but most of the lipids that the enterocyte are putting in your chylo are the triglycerides, of course. So it's a gigantic triglyceride-filled molecule, but there's a lot of absorbed cholesterol in it also. But trigs predominate. Because it's a gigantic balloon, the surface has an immense number of phospholipids on it, because it takes more phospholipids to create the surface of a big balloon than a little tiny balloon, like an HDL. All right, so the enterocyte actually transiently releases that chylomicron into our lymphatic circulation. And it travels up from our anatomy. Most people in layman, if you're listening, the lymphatic vessels empty into the arterial system, the venous system up in the neck. And all those intestinal chylomicrons join the bloodstream, the junction of the lymphatics and the blood vessel system. Now, what is the purpose of a chylomicron? Deliver triglycerides. Who wants triglycerides? Well, what happens when certain cells get triglycerides? There are lipases that cleave the triglycerides into fatty acids, which can enter through the cell membrane. So, and what does the cell do with fatty acids? It oxidizes them. And every time you lop off a carbon molecule from a fatty acid, you create ATP, the energy of life. What if I had to ask you, guess what cells require the most energy? They're the tissues that move a lot, our muscles. And I think we all have a muscle in the center of our chest that is contracting every second or so, and it needs a lot of energy to keep moving like that. No energy, no muscular movement, big trouble. So the chylomicrons are triglyceride delivery vehicles primarily. So they rush up to tissues that express an enzyme called lipoprotein lipase, just like the gut did. So if this big chylo shows up at a muscular cell, skeletal muscle, or a cardiac muscle, lipases are expressed, fatty acids are created, and they enter through the cell membranes, and they undergo beta oxidation, creating ATP. Now, what happens to the chylo as it loses all these triglycerides? It shrinks. Didn't give up any cholesterol. It doesn't deliver cholesterol to muscle cells or the heart. They can synthesize all their own cholesterol. They don't need cholesterol. But it becomes a much smaller VLDL that is now triglyceride poor and cholesterol rich. They're called remnants. Now look, they're still way bigger than IDLs, VLDLs, or LDLs, but they're basically carrying cholesterol, but a lot of cholesterol molecules. To put it into perspective, an LDL particle, if you're measuring cholesterol, LDL cholesterol is the major component of total cholesterol, but that's only because it hangs around several days, whereas the chylos and VLDLs disappear. But a typical LDL particle carries about 2,100 to 2,500 molecules of cholesterol. You'd say that's wrong. Remember the HDLs, they carried 45. So, but what does a chylo remnant or a VLDL carry? 6, 7, 8, 9,000 molecules of cholesterol. Thank God there aren't a lot of these. So, but what happens once the chylo has delivered its trigs? And by the way, when it shrinks, what breaks off of the surface? Phospholipids. Now, they can't circulate in plasma. They're a lipid. But evolution gave us a particle that scavengers phospholipids. So once phospholipids are released from chylos, and the same thing is going to happen to VLDLs in a minute, they bind to something called phospholipid transfer protein, PLPT. And what does it do with all these triglycerides? Remember I told you the little HDL is sucking cholesterol out of cells and it's getting bigger, bigger, bigger? What does the HDL need on its surface? Phospholipids. Where does it get it? Phospholipid transfer protein takes the phospholipids off of chylos and VLDLs and rushes them down and says, "Here, little baby HDL, you want to get bigger? Here's some phospholipids for your surface." It's unbelievable how evolution evolved lipid transportation. But anyway, in a normal circumstance, the chylo would give up its triglycerides. It's now only carrying absorbed cholesterol. It makes a beeline for the cell that has the most receptors that can clear it, the liver. And what does the liver grab to anchor a VLDL remnant and pull it in with all its cholesterol, which the liver will do something with? It has a specific receptor for chylomicrons called the LDL receptor-related protein, LRP. And that is looking for two things on a chylo that it can attach to with high affinity. The ApoB on a chylo, interestingly, has 48% of the molecular weight of the big ApoB that the liver manufactures for VLDLs and LDLs. It's a truncated ApoB, but it's still big, big particle. So that's called ApoB 48 because it has 48%. And that receptor is fine-tuned to recognize and grab ApoB 48. So that receptor will clear chylos preferentially. The second protein that chylos carry multiple copies of that binds to the LRP is Apoprotein E. Everybody knows about ApoE, but they relate it to the brain. But it's super crucial to triglyceride-carrying lipoproteins because it's as they lose their trigs, the ApoE changes shape a little bit and it assumes a shape that the LRP can bind to and pull it in. And this is why the half-life of a chylomicron is measured in minutes. Its plasma residence time is an hour or two. So that's why you will only find chylos if you're looking for them in a postprandial state. You start drawing blood 3, 4 hours after somebody ate and you're looking for ApoB 48, you're not going to find any because they're gone. Evolution wanted them to get this damn energy, these triglycerides to the muscle cells ASAP, and then get the cholesterol to the liver. Then we don't need you anymore. So that's how chylos come and go, give us a very wonderful way to transport energy and absorb cholesterol. For people who have genetic defects that they can't catabolize these triglycerides and chylos, these monstrous chylos float around your plasma forever. These are people who have triglyceride levels of 15, 20, 30,000. The primary genetic defect that does that is a lipoprotein lipase deficiency, as you can't hydrolyze the triglycerides. Thank God it's pretty rare and it's present with you at birth. These are children who, if it's not diagnosed early on, they start getting acute pancreatitis at ages 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, because that level of trig, that monstrous protein can invade your artery wall, but it can invade your pancreatic cells and destroy them. The fatty acids are tissue destructive. So pancreatitis is a big, big worry in those. Thank God we're now developing better ways of treating that. But even now, the primary way to treat such infants is they just can't eat saturated fat because that's what creates the triglycerides that overload these chylomicrons. So people who reckon these kids are on low-fat diets day one or month one, or else they're gonna, you would ultimately, if you weren't astute enough to check lipids early in an infant, you would certainly check them as they get their first episode of pancreatitis, a little infant. You'd know that's wrong. That's an aside. So that's the chylos. But, those muscles need a lot of energy, and maybe chylos can't even deliver enough trigs. So evolution gave us a big lipid-producing organ called the liver. So the liver is full of fat. It can make it de novo. It gets fatty acids and trigs the liver to it. So the liver can take any extra triglycerides, fat that it does not want, because why wouldn't the liver want to accumulate fatty acids? You would get a fatty liver. That's not good for survival of the liver long term. So the liver says, "Uh-oh, I got a triglyceride pool here. I'm going to enwrap them with ApoB." But the ApoB is ApoB 100. It's the full ApoB molecule. I'm going to stick some cholesterol ester in there to make it a nice circular particle, and then I'm going to shoot it into the arteries. And here come the VLDLs. Now, by the way, a chylomicron, if we're measuring its diameter when it's full, can be 200 to 300 angstroms, 200 to 300 nanomoles per liter. A VLDL, the biggest one that comes out, might be 140, 150 nanometers per liter. So you can see it's like half the size of a fully blown chylomicron. But it's still pretty big. It's carrying a lot of triglycerides. And it basically does what the Kylo does. It makes a beeline for muscles that are expressing lipoprotein lipase, cardiac, skeletal, and it's another supply of triglycerides. By the way, on the surface of Kylos and VLDLs is a protein that has tremendous affinity for the expressed lipoprotein lipase. It's called apolipoprotein C2, apolipoprotein C2. Kylos and VLDLs carry almost 100 molecules of C2, and that makes them rapidly bind to the lipoprotein lipase. But Kylos have more C2 than VLDLs, and that's why the plasma residence time and the half-life of Kylos is so short. But once they're done, then the VLDLs start binding and keep supplying energy. By the way, the half-life of a VLDL particle is not in minutes, but it's a couple of hours. Plasma residence time is like 6 hours, and then they're mostly gone. But look, you could check your triglyceride level at 9 o'clock at night, and you'd still get a triglyceride level. But if you have the perfect body that Cynthia just, your trig level would be 30 or 40. Yeah, many. If you did it right after a meal, if your trig was 30 or 40 at baseline, it might go to 70 or 80 after a meal. If you do a postprandial trig and it's much above 70, 100, God forbid 150, you know you have delayed metabolism. That's called lipolysis of your triglyceride-carrying particles. They're ApoB particles carrying cholesterol. You don't want to extend their half-life, and we'll tell you why as we get down to the LDLs. So now, interestingly, when the Kylo delivered its trigs, it was rapidly cleared by the liver. The VLDL, when it delivers its trig, is more slowly cleared. It doesn't have ApoB48 on it. So the LRP, it does have some ApoE, but less molecules than a Kylo. So it does get cleared at the liver quickly, not as quickly as a Kylo, but way more quickly than what's coming. So let's say a VLDL has delivered its trigs. It's now only carrying cholesterol, didn't deliver any cholesterol, and it's circulating through your body. So it's going to circulate through the liver, and the liver is going to grab it by recognizing ApoE. It's got a couple of ApoE molecules on it, or more importantly, ApoB100. And we have a very specific liver receptor that grabs ApoB like flypaper grabs flies. And that is called an LDL receptor. The one for Kylo's is LDL receptor related protein. This is the actual LDL receptor. Bingo! But the Kylo is back in the liver with a little bit of triglycerides it's still carrying, but all of the cholesterol it's still carrying. And believe it or not, as that VLDL was circulating around, it actually gathered some more cholesterol. People are saying, what? Okay.
One of the most common concerns I see in perimenopause and menopause is hair loss, hair breakage, hair shedding. And knowing that over 80 million Americans are impacted by this is both reassuring, but it's wonderful to know that there are products available that can help with these symptoms. Divi is good for those with hair shedding or thinning due to stress in perimenopause or menopause. They can be helpful for addressing dry scalp. And have you wanted to take control of your hair health but aren't sure where to start? This is where Divi can be hugely impactful. I love their scalp serum. And we know that the scalp serum improves the appearance of breakage, nourishes our hair follicles, and removes product and oil buildup. There are some key ingredients, including tea tree oil, which works to reduce and prevent excess oil buildup on the scalp, amino acids that help to strengthen hair, fight frizz, which is my greatest concern, and reduce breakage, and copper tripeptide 1, which is a small protein composed of the three amino acids to facilitate a clean and hydrated scalp, as well as hyaluronic acid, which is nourishing and hydrating to our scalps. As I mentioned, Divi is not just for those experiencing hair loss. I have found it to be hugely helpful for scalp health, and all of Divi's products, including their shampoos and conditioners, come together to create a full daily solution that helps women nourish their hair and get to the root of scalp health. Do you want to take back control of your hair and scalp health and do it with clean, science-backed ingredients? Go to diviofficial.com/Cynthia or enter Cynthia at checkout for 20% off your first order. That's D-I-V-I official.com/Cynthia for 20% off your first order. As I mentioned, my favorite product is the scalp serum. And now that we're in the deep throes of winter weather, it is so wonderfully nourishing and moisturizing. Have you guys heard about a bioactive whole food on the market with 5,000 published research studies backing it? When my oldest son needed to go on antibiotics a few months ago, I discovered Armra colostrum, and the benefits for him and his recovery from being on antibiotics have been instrumental in me now recommending this to my dairy non-sensitive patients and clients. Armra's colostrum strengthens immunity, ignites metabolism, fortifies gut health, promotes hair growth and skin radiance, and powers fitness, performance, and recovery. My son has mentioned to me over and over again how great his gut feels, how he has improved his digestion and gut function as well. Colostrum is a rich, exclusive source of immunoglobulins or antibodies that optimize our immune defense even during cold and flu season. And we know that mucosal barriers house over 80% of our body's immune cells, including the antibodies IgG and SIgA. And these immunoglobulins bind and intercept harmful particles like viruses, bacteria, and toxins, blocking them from crossing into the barriers into our bloodstream. And Armra's colostrum contains the highest levels of SIgA and IgG to ensure your most fortified first line of protection. It's sustainably sourced, and it's important to know that you want to mix colostrum only with cold liquids or foods, or dry scoop it into your mouth. This is also great for the oral microbiome. And we've worked out a special offer for my everyday wellness community where you can receive 15% off your first order. Go to tryarmra.com/Cynthia15 or enter Cynthia15 to get 15% off your first order. That's tryarmra.com/Cynthia15. You definitely want to check it out.
So, by the way, if a VLDL is returning cholesterol to the liver, it certainly didn't deliver cholesterol to any cell in your body. You would have to say part of the function of a VLDL is reverse cholesterol transport. And it is. And nobody was ever taught that the ApoB particles work with the HDLs on getting cholesterol back to the liver. All right. But now, as the VLDL is docking at the hepatocyte, because it wants to attach to the LDL receptor, there's another end hangs out with the LDL receptor. It's called hepatic lipase. It's not so much a triglyceridase, it's a phospholipase. It loves to hydrolyze phospholipids on the surface. So as the VLDL, and by the way, it's a smaller VLDL, so it's called the VLDL remnant. It's cholesterol rich, triglyceride poor. Some of the VLDLs actually undergo additional lipolysis, hydrolysis of remaining triglycerides and surface phospholipids. And so the VLDL actually shrinks to becomes a higher density particle because it's lost lipids. It becomes an IDL, an intermediate density lipoprotein. So the IDL still has a molecule or two of ApoE on it. It's certainly got ApoB100. So it's not long-lived for the world because the LDL receptor is going to grab it. But some of the IDLs at the liver undergo additional lipolysis by this hepatic lipase. Now, when you shrink an IDL a little bit, the ApoE breaks off. So the only protein left is ApoB100, but it's a much smaller particle now because it's lost some triglycerides and phospholipids. Its density is higher. So IDLs they transform into LDLs, low-density lipoproteins. Now, you would say, well, okay, the LDL will be instantly cleared by the LDL receptor. No. What does the LDL not have that the IDL had? ApoE. So the clearance of LDLs, which can only be done by an LDL receptor grabbing ApoB100, is much slower. IDL half-life is, again, half an hour. They're gone in 2 hours. The LDL, which has much slower receptor-mediated clearance, hangs around for 2, 3, 4, 5 days. Now, remember, there is one ApoB on every VLDL, IDL, and LDL. So if we ask the lab, give us an ApoB level, in essence, we're measuring VLDLs, IDLs, and LDLs that are floating around. But because of the much longer plasma residence time of LDLs, to 95% of an ApoB level that a lab reports to you is actually an LDL particle concentration. Your VLDLs and IDLs are a minuscule contributor to total ApoB. Chylos don't contribute at all because of their very short plasma residence time. And most of the time, we do these panels fast, where there would be no chylomicrons. So ApoB, we're going to talk about, is the blood test everybody needs. But when you get an ApoB level, you're basically getting LDL particles. And what's an LDL particle? It's basically a collection of cholesterol, very few triglycerides wrapped by one ApoB. It's a super cholesterol-rich particle. Where's the last place you want an LDL particle to invade? Your arterial wall. Because if it enters there, the ApoB on the particle sticks rapidly to the connective tissue in the intimal layer. The connective tissue is full of molecules called proteoglycans. Roots like the fly trapped on flypaper. They're stuck. A few may break off and exit back to the plasma, but most do not. They're trapped. Now, once they're trapped there, they're not supposed to be there. Our immune system goes into play. As if you're a bacteria invaded your body today, immune cells would go and attack it and try and kill it. Well, so once ApoB particles in the artery wall, the arterial wall sends out signals, white cells, help! They're chemotactic proteins for white cells that are expressed on the endothelium of the artery wall, and they start pulling in monocytes and ultimately other white blood cells that are floating around, T cells and B cells. And once in the arterial wall, a monocyte transforms into this big gobbler called a macrophage. And as the ApoB particles are sitting there bound to proteoglycans, and they're right next to one another, they start to aggregate. The phospholipids on their surface change positions and they like sticking to each other. And now all of a sudden you got multiple LDL particles congealing. That's called LDL aggregation. Like the first step of atherogenesis is the ApoB particle invading the artery. The second step is aggregation. But then those phospholipids, once they aggregate those particles, phospholipids are highly amenable to oxidation. Many of the fatty acids in the phospholipids have double bonds, very prone to oxidative forces. So if you have reactive oxygen species in your artery wall, and because of our lousy living, we have lots of them there, they start oxidizing these congealed LDL aggregates. And then you got a monstrous collection that gets pulled into the macrophage. Now, when you have all these sterols invading the macrophage, it's called a sterol-laden macrophage. They were discovered in 1914 by a Russian scientist, Anisimov, who was overfeeding rabbits cholesterol, and rabbits hyperabsorb cholesterol. And he was looking at their artery walls because rabbits get atherosclerosis, especially if you're drowning them with cholesterol in the diet. And he's had beautiful drawings of all, he didn't know what they were, but they're in retrospect foam cells in the artery wall. Now, over time, these foam cells, these macrophages fill with these cholesterol, they start attracting, it's a whole inflammatory mess that goes on. Smooth muscle cells are pulled in, they transform into abnormal smooth muscle cells. And over time, and we're talking decades here, you develop plaque. And ultimately, if that plaque keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger, it's going to extend into the lumen, obstructing the diameter of the lumen. If it obstructs it enough beyond 75% occlusion, you don't deliver blood and oxygen. That's called ischemia, as you know. God forbid that blockage closes the artery, nothing gets through, you infarct the tissue. And if it's the heart, myocardial infarction. That happens less and less nowadays. What really happens is this mess, this volcano full of sterols and inflammatory molecules, it's like a volcano, it erupts. And if it erupts through the endothelial barrier, all the gunk coming out of the plaque interacts immediately with the coagulation system, which wants to seal off the volcano. But what happens? You develop a thrombus, a clot. If it's a little clot, because of some ischemia. God forbid it's a big clot, you infarct. That's atherogenesis in a nutshell. You and I know, though, thank God, you can't like have a bad meal today, raise your ApoB level, and you're going to die tomorrow. This takes decades of the ApoB particles invading the arterial wall. See, this is why even kids who are born with familial hypercholesterolemia and have very high ApoB levels and LDL cholesterol levels, they don't get heart attacks when they're 5 years old, but they start getting them when they're 20 and 30 years old, depending on the severity of their ApoB level. The only exception to that rule is the poor little babies who absolutely picked the wrong mom and dads. They inherit evil genes from both. That's called homozygous familial hypercholesterolemia. As infants, when they're 1 and 2 years old, their LDL cholesterol is 300, 400, 500, 600 millimeters. And these are actually kids, if that's not recognized, actually get infarcts at age 5, 6, 7, and 8. Fortunately, nowadays, that's recognized more and more. Pediatricians are starting to check lipid levels much earlier in life. Sometimes the parents know they have familial hypercholesterolemia, so they would alert the pediatrician, God, I hope I didn't pass any genes down to my baby. And a wise pediatrician would check lipids very early in life there. So, but that's basically the story. I'm going to just wrap it up by, I sort of hinted to you, VLDLs actually gather cholesterol in their short plasma residence time, but so do LDLs in their several day. And now you're going to find out why they gave us LDL particles. Remember the HDLs that have sucked all the cholesterol and now they're big buoyant HDL particles full of cholesterol S. They bump into LDL particles, but also some VLDL particles because they're all. And by the way, we all have 28 more times more HDL particles in our plasma than we do LDLs or any other ApoB particles. So that even though they're small, that we got so many HDL particles. And as they bump into the LDL particles, we have a what's called a lipid transfer protein that HDLs carry in and it gets expressed. It's actually a protein tube that penetrates the ApoB particles, most of which are LDLs, but some are LDLs. And the HDL transfers its cholesterol ester into the LDL or the VLDL. And that's why evolution made LDLs hang around for so many days. Its primary purpose is not to deliver cholesterol to any tissue. It basically does none of that. It takes excess cholesterol out of the HDL, and the LDL or the VLDL returns cholesterol to the liver, completing the reverse cholesterol transport process. Now, look. The HDL also has the ability to go back to the liver and delipidate and get rid of its cholesterol, but half of it is given to the LDLs. So this very complex thing, and we were just taught reverse cholesterol transport, and we all were just taught it's just HDLs bringing back cholesterol to the liver. We got to re-explain it. Yes, HDLs are super important. They get the excess cholesterol out of the damn cells, but they give it to the ApoB particles to bring back to the liver. So when an ApoB particle brings cholesterol back to the liver, an LDL or VLDL, that is called indirect reverse cholesterol transport. If an HDL brings it back to the liver, that would be called direct RCT. Total RCT is a sum of direct and indirect. Now, I hate to make things more complicated, but these LDLs and HDLs can also return cholesterol to your intestine, which takes the cholesterol from them and exports it to the gut lumen so we can excrete it fecally. So you can see there are many avenues of lipid transportation in the bloodstream. And I dare anybody to come up and tell me whatever your HDL cholesterol is, whatever your LDL cholesterol is right now, what are your LDL and HDL particles doing? You know, lipid concentrations tell us a lot, basically identify but they tell you nothing about the functionality of what the heck the particles are doing in your blood. I'm going to totally wrap this up by saying HDLs don't give all their cholesterol to LDLs and VLDLs. They give a lot. By the way, that transfer protein is called cholesterol ester transfer protein, CETP. There are people who are born with loss of function genes. They don't make CETP. What do you think their HDL cholesterol is? 180, 190, because the HDL can't get rid of the cholesterol by giving it to it. Can't transfer cholesterol. Interestingly, that gene is associated with longevity. So it's kind of cool. And this is why for years, pharma has tried to develop a CETP inhibitor, all of which have failed. Well, the last one, it worked, but it didn't work that good. And it hung around the body forever, so Merck never brought it to market. That's anacetrapib. But right now, undergoing clinical trials is the latest version of a CETP inhibitor. And fingers crossed that it may work. And so far, in its early clinical trials, it's looking real good. It's called obicetrapib, OBI. So it'll be, I think, the fifth or sixth CETP inhibitor, but there's great promise for it.
It's so
So stay
interesting.
tuned to that. That'll be a future podcast. So I hope I've explained the last thing, HDLs can bring it to the liver, they can give it to an LDL, but HDLs happen to be a major supplier of cholesterol to steroidogenic tissue, our gonads and our adrenal cortex that make adrenal cortisone and crucial hormones that come from cholesterol. So those tissues make, under physiologic conditions, basically all the cholesterol they need. But under certain situations, stress or whatever, if your adrenal cortex needs to make more cortisone, it just expresses receptors that grab and delipidate HDL particles, SRB1, scavenger receptor B1. Whew. I think I've given you an indication of how complex lipid transportation by lipoproteins are. Atherogenesis, I've described to you. Perhaps the next question you're going to ask me is, Tom, what makes an ApoB particle invade the artery wall? Because if it didn't do that, you couldn't have atherosclerosis. Particle number. It's pretty much a diffusion process. Once your LDL particle number, ApoB, exceeds a certain level, and remember, it's over decades, it starts invading the artery wall, and atherogenesis slowly but surely begins. The higher your ApoB, the more quickly atherogenesis occurs. The FH kids, they get heart attacks at 20. Most of us get heart attacks at 50 or 60 because it took a little longer for our ApoB level to cause the heart attacks. But it's simply particle number. So you could measure ApoB, cheap, affordable, done at every lab in America at least. There is a more sophisticated test using nuclear magnetic resonance or ion mobility transfer that can give you an LDL particle count by itself. Basically, LDL particle count is ApoB. So any of those measures will work. Quest uses ion diffusion mobility, which reports the LDL particle number. LabCorp, Boston Heart, Cleveland also would give you the nuclear magnetic resonance, the NMR, lipoprotein concentrations, and total LDLP is the most important number you get out of them. There's other metrics they give you, but total LDLP and ApoB is basically what you need. What don't you need? HDL cholesterol or ApoA1, because there are too many ApoA1 molecules per particle, so it gives you no usable information. HDL cholesterol, it's such a dynamic process where it's gaining and losing, gives you no information. HDLs are super crucial lipoproteins, not because of the cholesterol they carry, although that's important. It's the proteins they carry. There have been almost 200 proteins described that you will find on the surface of some HDL particles. Now, each one carries three or four proteins, but as I said, quintillions of HDL particles. So, and it's the proteins that determine what we call the functionality of the HDL particle. Is it doing good things to the artery wall? Is it doing bad things to the artery wall? That's called dysfunctional HDLs. Some of these proteins are anti-cancerous, so HDLs are involved with the immunity or with oncogenesis. Some of these proteins kill bacteria, so they're involved with immune. You get an infection someplace, HDLs run. You ever notice if you shouldn't do it, but if you did a lipid panel and somebody went in acute crisis, an infection, their HDL cholesterol is low because the HDLs are being destroyed at the infective sites by delivering proteins that help our immune cells. So HDLC is cool, but it tells us nothing. But I can tell you, when go back to that, your brother-in-law who has a low HDL cholesterol and high triglycerides, hey, if he's got high trigs, his liver is making too many VLDLs that become too many LDLs. His liver is even overproducing LDLs. His ApoB is through the roof. So the poor man's best way, if you don't want to order ApoB, and you're just starting with a lipid profile, if you see a high triglyceride HDL cholesterol ratio, you order ApoB, it's going to be ugly when it comes back. So low HDL cholesterol is just a signal of insulin resistance, and your ApoB level is much higher than you want it. And therefore, the proper treatment to anybody with high ApoB, including those with low HDL cholesterol, is to lower ApoB through lifestyle, and if necessary, if your risk is disastrous, enough through pharmacology. And if we all did that, and this is why ApoB measurements are early in life, because they go out of whack sooner than those LDL cholesterol. The triglycerides, even that takes a long while to go up. If first you'll get insulin going up, and then postprandial insulin first, then fasting insulin. But all of this metabolic mess is occurring in these people. So I'll take a deep breath and you can ask me more questions.
No, there's so much here to unpack, but it helps explain why this is a complicated business, why, in many ways, it's my opinion that we have taken a complicated process and tried to just take a total cholesterol and HDL and LDL and triglyceride and make that the whole story. And really what you are identifying here is it's one step in the process, and we need to look beyond those basic metrics. And you talked about the poor man's ApoB. So if you have a regular lipid panel, you can look at your VLDL, your LDL, your HDL to get a sense of what your ApoB must be. But the ApoB is really where it's at. This is something that for me, I am exquisitely attuned to, not just because I'm a lipid nerd, but because I, through genetics, have a high ApoB. And we'll probably at some point, if not on this podcast, we will discuss my own lipids because I think it's important to be transparent and say, I'm doing all the right things, and still some of this is genetically mediated. So for
Yeah, and I'd
people,
be happy to give you my lipid panel one day too, which is probably a bit worse than yours, but I have it under perfect control and can't wait
no,
to
and
do it.
it's interesting. It's because of my ApoB that I started, because the lifestyle was already dialed in.
Sure.
It's because of my ApoB that I actually started taking medication. And we'll get to a point where we'll talk about people that are hyperabsorbers of cholesterol, and I happen to be one of those. But let's talk a little bit about ApoB. We know it impacts the arterial walls. We know if we were to draw an ApoB on an infant versus a child versus an adult, like where those numbers should be. So if people are listening and they're interested in getting this lab drawn, where are those numbers supposed to be? So at birth, my understanding is between 20 to 30 milligrams per deciliter. Is that correct?
It is.
Okay. And then, as children, children progress, 40 to 50
And
milligrams.
by the way, just an aside there, because there's so many people who panic when they see low ApoB or low LDL cholesterol. At that age, infancy, they are developing their most important organ in the body, which is super cholesterol rich, the brain. So these kids having low LDL cholesterols and low ApoB have no problems with brain development. So that reinforces something I dropped early. What's floating around our plasma has zero to do with what's floating around our brain. And I want to certainly in the future talk to you more about the brain. But don't panic when you see a little baby with an LDL-C of 25. That's a normal kid. And that kid is probably going to develop into a normal brain and everything's going to work. Sooner or later, you got to know the ApoB because it will hurt the artery walls, but not if it stayed 20 to 30. No atherosclerosis in that kid.
Mighty Maca is a superfood drink mix full of 30 plus natural ingredients, and it was formulated by Dr. Anna Kabeca during her healing journey. Mighty Maca Plus ingredients, which include nourishing ingredients like organic maca powder, turmeric, quercetin, broccoli, parsley, trans resveratrol, pomegranate extract, and more, were carefully selected for immune support to sustain energy, provide mental clarity, and improve recovery. It also tastes delicious. It supports healthy detoxification and alkalinity in the body, balances hormones, fights free radicals, and neutralizes lactic acid, all while increasing your energy and vitality. It helps improve your digestion and reignites your libido. It's a powerful superfood drink mix that needs to be part of your daily routine. And Dr. Anna is offering my listeners 10% off your first purchase by using the link dranna.com/Cynthia. That's 10% off your first that's 10% off your first purchase by using the link dranna.com/Cynthia. It's delicious and nutritious. Americans spend an average of 90% of their time indoors and take about 20,000 breaths a day. The indoor air that we breathe is 2 to 5 times more polluted than outdoor air, and in some circumstances, up to 100 times more polluted, according to the EPA. And did you know that air pollution is responsible for nearly 7 million premature deaths globally? So what's the solution? I want to introduce you to a product by Air Doctor that has captured the attention of established media outlets like CNN, ABC, and more. Air Doctor filters out 99.99% of dangerous contaminants so that your lungs don't have to. This includes pollutants such as allergens, pollen, pet dander, dust mites, mold spores, and even bacteria and viruses that have the potential to go on and make us sick. Air Doctor comes with a 30-day, breathe easy, money-back guarantee. So if you don't love it, just send it back for a refund minus shipping. Head to airdoctorpro.com and use code Cynthia. You'll receive up to $300 off air purifiers. Exclusive to podcast customers, you will also receive a free 3-year warranty on any unit, which is an additional $84 in value. Look at the special offer by going to airdoctorpro.com and use promo code Cynthia. I absolutely love my air filters. They're an integral component to ensuring that the air that my family breathes in our home is as safe as possible. Well, and I think it's important to talk about, like, where do we ideally want in someone who does not have insulin resistance, who is metabolically healthy, yes, has known coronary artery disease, no diabetes, where do you want the ApoB to be as an adult? This is an important metric. So here's a pearl we're introducing because I want people to be able to walk away and say, okay, this is the metric I need to work towards.
Yes. The laymen who are listening, if you run to your doctor on your next appointment and said, you listened or you learned that ApoB is important and they want it, and your physician, clinician, whoever you're seeing tells you ApoB is not important, nobody measures it, I joke, run out of that office as fast as your legs will carry you and find a practitioner who, before even making an appointment with a doctor, if you're an adult, say, by the way, does the doctor check ApoB? And if the person answering the phone says yes, you're probably in good hands. So, at aside, this is so crucial and so important. And the reason is, you could say, why can't I just use LDL cholesterol? Because especially for those in the insulin-resistant world, but in others, all of a sudden, there are certain people where the LDL cholesterol does not correlate with the ApoB. The LDL-C may look fantastic, but ApoB could be a nightmare. Or vice versa, the LDL-C could look scary, but the ApoB is good. No risk at all. So the risk more closely follows ApoB than does any of these cholesterol or even triglyceride metrics you're hearing about. They're good guesstimates, but ultimately you want the real test. Cynthia started off by saying, geez, perhaps we'll ultimately get into menopausal women because, you know, at certain points in our lifespans, gender's obviously different, things change. So why doesn't these little babies who have ApoB of 40 or 50, why doesn't that stay 40 or 50 for their whole lives? And whatever your ApoB is as a woman, when you go through menopausal transition, why does it start going out of whack? What forces might be at play? And the same with men. Why is it out of whack earlier in life more in men than it is in women? So everything we've taught you so far, we're going to try and translate into, it does change, and this is why you have to keep periodically repeating ApoB and lipid panels. It's not just a one-time test in your life. So, and I hope we get into all these scenarios. Would you like me to explain what levels should be as we age? Or
I would love that. And then it would be helpful to hear from you, because I love, and this is one of the reasons why I knew when I connected with you, I was like, this is my person that I know is designed to bring this information to my community. Was when you were in clinical practice in New Jersey, your specialty was looking at lipids and managing women in perimenopause and menopause. And you said to me, because these women have really been, you know, so poorly managed is probably an understatement. But I think, you know, after the Women's Health Initiative in 2002, a lot of women were taken off their hormone replacement therapy. And we know that HRT can be beneficial for helping to kind of quiet inflammation, oxidative stress, and why in particular, I wanted you to be the one to talk about it, because you had many, many years of clinical experience discussing this with your patients in particular.
No, so important. And Cynthia's right. When I left practice in New Jersey in 2012, moved to Virginia because I became part of Biomarker Laboratories down here. And I was getting to be an older man, so sooner or later, you got to leave practice. But anyway, as I evolved my practice, I did evolve into women's healthcare. And it was certainly lipids, but it was every aspect of a woman, her bones, her breasts, her pelvic organs. And the reason why is because for whatever reason, I was very interested in that. I used to joke, well, ultimately, I was married to a menopausal woman, so I had to make sure everything was good with her. That's not a joke to even use anymore, but it worked in my day. But anyway, what Cynthia says, I noticed, and I would because I evolved into I'm caring about, they were getting such crappy care all over the place. And their doctors were not talking to them about all the multiple issues. And, you know, again, one of my New Jersey jokes, when a woman walks into your office and you're a physician, it's not just her breasts and her vagina that you have to be cared about. The woman has a brain. The woman has a heart. Woman's full of arterial blood vessels. The woman has joints. So you have to, if you're going to say, I care for women, you better know the total woman. And when this started to evolve, even a lot of gynecologists started, I'm changing my practice to a women's clinic. But they just looked at the breasts and the pelvic. They didn't look at the brain or the arterial wall for sure. That was many of them have evolved into doing that just now. Good luck finding them. But I stumbled into that world because I felt bad for the women. Because you'd get talking to women and, you know, I'm there, hey, I'm your internist. I'm doing blood pressure. I'm checking your lipids. By the way, has anybody talked to you about bone density? Has anybody talked to you about your emotional well-being? Is there dementia in your family? Blah, blah, blah. By the way, even gynecologists sometimes get into sexual functioning of a woman. This is all so important. And I don't know, but I stumbled into that world. At the time I stumbled into it, there was a new organization forming at that time called the North American Menopause Association. And they were a group of scientists that were actually, hey, we're going to start. There's thousands of women. The baby boomers are all turning into menopausal women right now. So it's a big issue. And we got involved, actually started the journal Menopause. They were the people who, a wonderful journal, few unfortunately know about. But anyway, they actually started a board examination for menopausal health care. And they actually started their board organization before the National Lipid Association started their American Board of Clinical Lipidology certification. So I jumped right into NAMS and I passed the menopausal board certification. And a few years later, when the lipid board came, I passed that, of course. And I'm very proud for, there's no monument to me anywhere, but I'm the first clinician in the world who was certified by both NAMS and the American Board of Clinical Lipidology. So I immediately changed my business card. I have to scan you and send. It was called the North Jersey Institute of Menopausal Lipidology. And I just felt I was doing so good to women. My staff hated me because that meant at least an hour, hour and a half discussion with every woman. And that's not a way for an internist to make a lot of money. Luckily, I evolved into education, so I had an educational income that allowed me to spend so much time with women. But there is so much to discuss, and it's become 10 times more complicated even than when I was one of the early people in this field. One of the things I'm proud of, I ultimately became an editor of the, not an editor, but a sub-editor of the Journal of Clinical Lipidology. And I obviously did a ton of peer review or asked other people, but I also did several peer reviews for the journal Menopause because Isaac Schiff, who is an editor, went whenever there was a lipid issue, he often, Tom, would you review this article? And I remember, I was a lot of gynecologists in that organization, so it felt so good to do that. But anyway, that's how I stumbled into that world. And sadly, even today, if you're a woman, really good luck getting good comprehensive meta. It's better than it was, but you have to be proactive. You have to search. Not only do you have to ask your doc, you know, what ApoB is, but I'm a woman. Are you going to evaluate my brain, any cognitive things that might predispose it, what things in the mammogram other than you squeezing them tell me anything, the pelvic exam, what issues, it all has to be addressed. We did have that studies that all came into play in the late 90s, and where before that it was religion that if you were a woman, you had to be on estrogen. Even back in the days before we knew, they were getting unopposed estrogen, for God's sakes. And that's not a happy ending for your uterus. But ultimately, progestins were invented and they came on board. But the bones, who was looking at bones? You know, your spine is going to be crooked when you're 80 years old. Who cares when you're 40 years old? We don't have to worry about that. Yes, that's the opportune time to work. So that was an issue. The whole pelvic floor was just another issue. And that is addressed differently than what you, if you're going to use estrogen, you're doing systemic. But if you don't know this, you can't do it. So the last joke I'll make is, you know, so gynes were all estrogen and they slowly evolved into knowing, hey, Estrogen is a great drug for the right woman, and it's not the right drug for another class of women. So you obviously have to figure out who that's for. The problem with hormone replacement therapy or menopausal hormone therapy, as it's now called, is internists want nothing to do with it. The biggest panic phone call an internist can get is, "I'm a woman with vaginal bleeding. Oh my God." So they just punt to gyne. They don't want to even discuss those important parts, and there are few are going to prescribe appropriate hormone therapy during the menopause transition, where maybe use a high dose OC and then evolve into menopausal hormone. It's just so frustrating. And I feel for women. I really do. As do you, and you know this as well as I do. You just introduced this. So important.
If you love this podcast episode, please leave a rating and review, subscribe, and tell a friend.